Hi, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Today is Friday, today's the May 4th, 2012, and I'm your host, Alon Cohen, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Addison Cole.
Hello.
Unfortunately, I had the bad decision to ride into the co-op station today, so I'm a bit wet.
Okay, we won't notice that on the air.
Yeah, but I will. So Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage a movement toward a world in which all animals, both human and non-human, are treated with compassion and care. We strive to expose all the complicated relationships we share with all the critters of this planet and wish that all animals be able to flourish to their full potential. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and is also streamed live at co-opradio.org and available on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. On today's show, we will be discussing the condition of farmed animals in Canada, a topic that doesn't get much treatment as usually farmed animals and industrialized practices are discussed in the U.S. context, and also we'll be discussing the relationship between animal rights and anarchism. If you listen closely to the show, you'll hear a subtle debate between welfareism and abolitionism in today's show, but you'll have to listen really carefully for that.
I'll be listening.
That's good to know. So there are 20 times more farmed animals than people in Canada today, but a drive through the countryside doesn't give you that impression. The World Society for the Protection of Animals has released a new report entitled What's on Your Plate? The Hidden Costs of Industrial Animal Agriculture in Canada, and exposes the destructive impacts of intensive livestock operations, or ILOs, on our health, the environment, animal welfare, and rural Canada. For our first interview today, we'll be chatting with Melissa Matlow, the campaign's manager for humane and sustainable agriculture for the World Society for the Protection of Animals. The WSPA has been promoting animal welfare for more than 25 years with a focus on companion animals, commercial exploitation of wildlife, farm animals, and disaster management. In today's interview, Melissa will tell us just how ILOs, or intensive livestock operations, are producing drug-resistant superbugs, destroying our planet's life support systems, and transforming the social fabric of our rural communities. Later in the show, we'll be talking about a problem close to home in Vancouver, specifically BC, the Enbridge oil pipelines, and what they mean for non-human animals and the environment. For our second interview today, we have Dr. Abraham P. De Leon on the show. He is an assistant professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Recently, Dr. De Leon was scheduled to deliver a paper entitled Lured by the Animal, Rethinking Non-Human Animals in Educational Discourses at the American Education Research Association conference here in Vancouver, BC. He was also scheduled to speak at the pre-conference on what might happen when teachers and other academics connect reason to power and power to resistance. However, rather ironically, he was denied entry into Canada to attend this conference. We'll be talking to Abraham about his work on animals and anarchist philosophy, and we'll hopefully see how anarchism provides both profound insights into the way animals are treated in our society and also improve tools for how we can challenge this oppression. So you're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 Co-op Radio, CFRO. Let's jump right in with Addison and the events for this week.
All right, this is what I have for this coming week. Actually, let's see here. Saturday, May the 5th, that's tomorrow, the Vancouver Animal Defense League and Saving Animals will be hosting a weekly vegan outreach event. This is happening at the Metrotown SkyTrain station by the ticket vending machines in Burnaby. Come join VADL and Saving Animals Canada, which are two nonprofit organizations here locally, for their weekly vegan outreach leafletting. They will be handing out information booklets in hopes that people will read them and stop eating meat. This week, as I said, they will be at Metrotown SkyTrain station by the overpass leading to the mall. They will be there for approximately 1 hour, and afterwards they'll head to a cafe or a vegan restaurant for snacks and socializing. So for more information, you can go to either VancouverAnimalDefenseLeague.org blogspot.ca, or I think it's .com, sorry, and Saving Animals Canada at www.saving-animals.ca. You can also check out this event, which is posted at meetup.com/animal-rights-advocacy, which is a recently started meetup group where this and other future animal advocacy events will be posted. On Sunday, May the 6th, that's coming up this weekend at 12:30 p.m., Veg Meetup Vancouver presents a vegan dim sum lunch at Pokong Vegetarian Restaurant at 1334 Kingsway in Vancouver. It's a fun, animal-friendly social food event. 10 to 12 people can usually sit together at big round tables, so it's easier to talk to everyone. And I know that these dim sum events usually attract, like, dozens and dozens of people, so I haven't checked to see how many people that this one has. I know a last one that was in town, I mean, there were over 100 people there. Come early if you want to pick a spot you like. Most people do come alone, so don't be afraid to come on your own. So there's going to be a set menu, and on it there will be spinach dumpling, snow fungus dumpling, rice sheet roll, fried bean curd skin roll, pan-fried turnip cake, pan-fried pot sticker, deep-fried taro dumpling, Shanghai-style dumpling, pan-fried veggie bun, and Chinese tea. So you get all of this for only $11 per person. That includes tax and tip and the chip-in for the meetup fee. Isn't that a deal, Elon?
Sounds great to me.
I'm not a dim sum person, but if I was, I would be going to this. Pre-registration is necessary for this event. So to do so, go to meetup.com/vegvan, and you can RSVP there. On Sunday, May the 6th at 2 p.m., that's this weekend again, at the Vancouver Animal Defense League will be having their monthly meeting at Café du Soleil, which is a vegetarian restaurant at 2096 Commercial Drive in Vancouver. The local animal activist group, VADL, will now be meeting the first Sunday of every month to plan campaigns and events. At this meeting, on the 6th of May, they will be discussing their upcoming Shark Fin campaign, which will start approximately mid-May. If you want to take action for animals in Vancouver, then they ask you to join them to work on the Shark Fin campaigns, fur, foie gras, marine mammals, vegan outreach, and more. Email them if you want to be added to their Facebook group and email list for more campaign and event updates. You can also go to Vancouver Animal Defense League at live.ca, so that's email. And then once again, their email address is vancouveranimaldefenseleague.blogspot.ca. I guess it is .ca. And then finally, on Wednesday, May the 9th at 1 p.m., there is a documentary film festival happening right now. It's called Doxa, and they'll be screening the film called Love Meat Tender, which is Love Meat Tender. Get it? So this is happening at the Pacific Cinematheque at 1131 Howe Street in Vancouver. What's the price of pleasure most of us take for granted every day? This documentary gives us a clear answer, and it's not pretty. Meat consumption is one of the major factors in climate change behind every sticky cold cut, every juicy steak, every McDonald's hamburger is a small contribution to a big problem. Love Meat Tender is an engaging and surprisingly upbeat look at an industry out of whack, tracing the history of our culinary habits, outlining the disastrous rise of corn-fed cattle, and breaking down the science of our meat addiction. The movie lays out a sober case with surprising cheer. The facts here are so damning that there's no need to preach. In a situation as dire as this, simple education is activism. The film is chock full of statistics, tables, and graphics, but this is no square screed. It's a fun, optimistic call for change. So to find out more about this film, you can go to doxafestival.ca for more info. And I just wanted to mention that Alyssa is actually going to be watching it next week on behalf of Animal Voices, and she'll be providing a review of this film on next week's show. Sounds good, huh, Elon?
Sounds great
to
me.
Yeah, it's nice to see that they will be having at least one film, and this is the only film I could see, actually, that was sort of animal-focused. But if you're into seeing the new documentary films, go to doxafestival.ca. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. All I really wanted.
to do is make a living singing songs. But how will I get on the radio when I cuss and swear and sing about loving women? I sing about loving women.
Meet Four Lesbians by Lesbians. The Lesbian Show on 102.7 CFRO has been providing music and news for almost 30 years.
You're my sister, you're my brother. When they ask you, you check other.
The Lesbian Show, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. For more information, contact lesbianshow at yahoo.com.
You are listening to Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territories, Canada. So right now I want to talk about a problem that's fairly close to home in BC here. The Enbridge Northern Gateway Project is actually one of four major pipeline projects proposed for northern British Columbia over the next 5 years. And I imagine just about anyone living in BC has heard about this proposed project, as it's been slightly documented on the news, but really it's been floating everywhere online and by word of mouth. The project would consist of two 1,200 kilometer pipelines, one to transport unrefined oil from the Alberta tar sands to tankers on British Columbia's coast, and the other to move petroleum condensate east from British Columbia to Alberta. In total, more than 700,000 barrels of petroleum products would cross the rivers, mountains, and valleys of northern British Columbia each day. I want to introduce just one of the many problems associated with the pipelines, a topic I hopefully will return to in shows in the future. But for today, I want to talk specifically about salmon. The Enbridge oil pipelines would cross and in some places run parallel to major salmon rivers in British Columbia's Upper Fraser, Skeena, and Kitimat watersheds, which contain some of the highest quality habitat for wild salmon and steelhead trout in Canada. Between 1999 and 2008, Enbridge recorded 610 spills that released 132,000 barrels of hydrocarbons into farms, wetlands, and waterways on the continent. According to the Polaris Institute, this volume of crude amounts to approximately half of the oil that spilled from the oil tanker, the Exxon Valdez, after it struck a rock in Prince William Sound, Alaska in 1988. In one day, however, the Enbridge pipeline would transport almost twice the amount of oil that the Exxon Valdez spilled. With a flow rate of roughly 6 barrels of oil a second, the pipeline would transport enough oil to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool in 43 minutes. So we need to realize that it's not a question of if, but when the pipelines will burst and spill, given the amount and the quality in which these happen and the quantity in which these happen, rather. But degradation of salmon habitats don't even require a pipeline explosion or spill to happen. The greatest impact on salmon happen during pipeline constructions, when the pipelines are built across streams or rivers. Runoff and discharge from excavating and draining trenches, disposing to fill material, and testing the pipes can end up in rivers and streams. This raises water temperatures and results in increased levels of sediment, including pollutants such as total dissolved solids. Increased sediment in rivers and streams can reduce the availability of food, smother spawning habitats, and irritate the gills of fish, making it more difficult for them to breathe. So what happens when it does actually burst? Well, heavier tar sand petroleum, such as bitumen, sinks and collects along riverbeds, log jams, and shorelines, slowly releasing toxins over a long, prolonged period of time. The toxins can cause chronic growth problems in salmon. Condensate is lighter and more acutely toxic to fish and wildlife. It can impact long distances of river and cause large fish kills before evaporating after several days. And we've already experienced two major oil spills in Canada. 1 million liters of petroleum spilled from a pipeline in the Pine River upstream of Chetwynd in northeast British Columbia, causing a massive fish kill that extended over 20 kilometers downstream. Despite $30 million spent in cleanup costs, the river is still not oil-free. Similarly, at Lake Wabamun in Alberta, a derailed train spilled 750,000 liters of heavy oil. Again, despite cleanup efforts, heavy oil spills still persist at the bottom of the lake. This spill actually demonstrated to us that the behavior of heavy oil in freshwater environments is not well understood and extremely difficult to clean up. So we can see that protecting salmon and their habitat means opposing the Enbridge oil pipeline, something I hope everyone listening is already in favor of opposing. So this is not just one of the many reasons to do so. This is one of many reasons to do so, other reasons that hopefully I'll get to in the future of the show. So if you actually want to learn more about pipelines and how to help stop them, you should get in touch with one of the many organizations involved in these issues, such as the Wilderness Committee, or I believe they're called the Wilderness Committee now. They used to be called the Western Wilderness Committee, Dogwood Initiative, Greenpeace, and many other organizations. A simple Google search would actually allow that, but it's hopefully a problem that will be opposed and alleviated in the future, because I do not want to see these pipelines being built in BC. So now we're actually going to turn to our first interview. We have Melissa Matlow on the phone. She's the Campaigns Manager for Humane and Sustainable Agriculture for World Society for the Protection of Animals. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Very good, thank you.
So the WSPA actually just released a report about industrial animal agriculture. So what was the incentive for doing this report at this particular moment in time, and what is unique about it regarding the Canadian context?
Oh, sure. Well, the Canadian government is right now looking at how to revise their agricultural policy for our country. And during the last election, all of the opposition parties proposed ideas for a national food policy. But in all of those plans, animal welfare and the significant issue of industrial animal agriculture and its many impacts on Canadians' lives was completely missing from all these plans. So that was one reason we wanted to get into that debate. But also, 4 years ago, the prestigious Pew Environment Commission established a committee to look at this issue in the U.S., and their groundbreaking report that was released had a tremendous impact on the discourse and the political debate in the U.S., and various bills have been brought forward and debated, and there's really been a change in discussion in the U.S., and we wanted to see that happen in Canada.
So is it fair to say that this is actually the first report about industrialized farming in Canada?
That's right, yeah. It's the first of its kind. It's the first comprehensive report that looks at not only the impact of this type of farming system on animals, but also on public health, our environment, and rural communities in Canada.
So could you give us a bit about the history? What did Canadian farming practices look like before industrialization? What do they look like now, and how are these processes really changed?
Sure. Well, over the last 6 years, we've seen a tremendous shift in the way we produce food. There's been a drastic decline in the number of farms, and the average number of animals on each farm has risen significantly. So we have about 20 times more farm animals in Canada than people. But a drive through the countryside wouldn't give you that impression, because many of these animals are hidden from our view. The vast majority are kept in these large windowless barns, never to experience fresh air or sunshine until the day they are sent to slaughter. In the report, we call these farms intensive livestock operations, or ILOs, but probably they're more commonly known as factory farms. And so that's a big shift in the way we're producing food from way back before the war, when it was more common to see many family-owned and controlled and managed mixed farms that were small to medium size and scale.
Okay, great. So let's actually discuss some of the report's, I guess, themes. So the report's split into kind of four big sections: as public health, rural communities, environment, and animals. So let's actually touch about the public health aspect. So what are the dangers and impacts to the public health of humans and non-humans from these industrialized practices?
Well, ILOs, or factory farms, are the perfect environment for encouraging the spread of pathogens and drug-resistant bacteria, and for the emergence of novel, more pathogenic viruses. It really probably comes as little surprise when you think about the environment these animals are kept on. We're talking about thousands of genetically uniform, stressed animals in crowded, unhealthy conditions. So you can see how it is a perfect storm for creating these multi-drug resistant superbugs. And that's another issue that our report covered, is the increasing concern of antibiotic resistance. Farm animals in Canada receive more drugs than people do, and the vast majority are not used to treat animals that are sick. The majority are used to promote growth and prevent disease, and it's having a huge impact on the effectiveness of life-saving drugs for people and for animals in veterinary medicine because of the increasing concern of drug-resistant bacteria being developed. So one of our report recommendations is to phase out that unnecessary use of agricultural antibiotics. But the other health concerns, I think mad cow disease really highlights everything that's wrong with the system. There's an example where we ignore the animal's nature, its very diet, and gave cows, other cows, as a cost-saving measure. And that's, you know, really highlights what's wrong with the system. That's all about, with the one goal of producing higher volumes of meat, milk, and eggs as quickly and as cheaply as possible. Our report shows that there's many costs. It's not actually a cheap system. We're paying for that system in so many other ways.
But of course, these conditions aren't just detrimental to the animals, the non-human animals working in these conditions, but also to the human animals that are working in these farms as well, right?
Yeah, there's absolutely a danger to the farm workers. They're most at risk. I mean, they're in the same environment as the animals, so they're at risk of these drug-resistant bacteria getting into their systems, preventing them from making effective use of life-saving drugs if they fall ill. They breathe in noxious gases. Many farm workers have died just from inhaling the fumes from hydrogen sulfide gas, which comes from manure. So they're at great risk. It is definitely a very risky job for them. And also, of course, consumers are at risk from bacteria such as Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria. I mean, Canadians really, understand now the serious implications of Listeria and contaminated meat, which can cause illness, but even death.
Okay, so let's turn to the rural communities now. ILOs, or intensive livestock operations, obviously cannot be divorced from the forces of capital and capitalism and this kind of system of profit-making. So can you speak a bit about the relationship between ILOs and these forces of money-making and how this has affected rural communities?
Yeah, we're really interested in, when we got back the contributions from the rural economists and sociologists that worked on our report, because it shed a light on the fact that no one's really gaining from the system. The farmers in the rural communities aren't benefiting from it either, and I don't think we fully understood that negative ramification before we embarked on this project. But the report shows that as productivity has increased with intensive livestock operations producing more and more meat, milk and eggs, farm debt loads have actually soared, and the average farmer now carries a debt of about $23 for every net dollar earned. So rural communities are not benefiting from the system. The whole purpose of intensive livestock operations producing food so cheaply means they're cutting costs, and they're cutting costs in the labor area as well. So rural communities are plagued with increasing unemployment and increasing poverty rates, and a lot of farmers now have to supplement their income off the farm. So we really learned a lot from that contribution to a report to show that it's really not benefiting anyone but agribusiness.
So, but of course, what about the role of the state in this? Your report also highlights that both federal and provincial governments have a vested interest in livestock operations, providing a large amount of subsidies. Can you actually talk about the role of the state as well? And also, is the both provincial and federal governments, are they also benefiting from these processes?
Well, I think everyone was led to believe back in the 60s that this was the way to go, that it really would bring us food to feed the growing populations. I'm not sure if the government is necessarily the bad guys here, but it's been a practice to give out subsidies to these large intensive livestock operations, and the practice has not been criticized until now. What we found is that the vast majority of subsidies are going to the biggest hog producers, for instance, but the government's not only propping up these systems through subsidies, they're propping up these intensive farms through the lack of environmental regulations and enforcement. And that's surely they're being lobbied hard. Anytime a group has asked for stronger regulation, they're probably being lobbied by the agribusiness companies to hold back and to let matters continue as usual.
Great, thanks. And of course, the issue of rural communities is often not highlighted when it comes to these suffering of the animals. But one of the other issues that usually also isn't highlighted in this issue is the environment. And so we often actually see a split between the environmental movement and the animal rights movement, a split that actually your report shows us is both factually inaccurate and also potentially dangerous. So how do ILOs actually contribute to the degradation of our environment and biodiversity loss?
Sure. Well, I'm actually really surprised that, there's really no environmental groups picking up this issue, because intensive animal agriculture is a top contributor to the biggest environmental issues facing our planet. It is responsible for significant greenhouse gas emissions, uses more land and water than any other human activity, and is the biggest threat to biodiversity than any other human activity. And that's largely because of the sheer number of animals that are involved in the vast quantities of feed and the vast amounts of manure they produce. and the intensive production of the feed crops that, you know, wouldn't be dependent on if they were out on pasture grazing. So there's a significant environmental input and footprint, and we hope that this report really makes environmental groups join our cause.
I wonder if you actually talked to an issue that the report highlighted. So the report actually claims that animal agriculture is responsible for releasing more than 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, which is claimed to be twice the global warming potential than all cars. Can you actually explain why this is the case? And does this figure also include all vehicles on the road, or is it just cars that are used for, I guess, ordinary pleasure as such?
And is this figure worldwide or in Canada?
This is worldwide, and it's actually the CO2 equivalent. So it's looking at all the greenhouse gas emissions related to CO2. So it's looking at methane as well and nitrous oxide. But it's based on the fact that the average car, so we're just looking at cars, emits 5 tons of carbon dioxide per year. And at this time that we found that stat, there were 600 million cars in the world. I think now there's probably more than 1 billion cars, but there's also more livestock. So we expect that ratio to still be very similar.
Okay, great, thanks. So let's actually talk about the animals now. And I don't want to dwell on this point too much because it seems to be something, A, that's, of course, rather sad, and something that is usually the main focus when we actually think about these issues and these ILOs. So we shouldn't be surprised that industrialized slaughterhouses are, of course, indeed really harmful to animals. But did the report find anything that was particularly startling or may have not been as apparent in the past when these issues were discussed?
I think nothing was startling to us. And it's probably a lot of the animal welfare issues in the report are probably common knowledge to many of the show's listeners. But I imagine it would be startling information to many Canadians, and that's why we felt it was very important to make these linkages and still find another way to get it out again to the average Canadian, because while we care so much about it, let's face it, a lot of people either don't know or they don't want to know. And we also are trying to educate politicians, the policymakers. You know, there's a reason why animal welfare isn't in their food policy, or it's at the bottom of the list of priorities. So we need to keep raising this issue. But certainly, you know, the key farm animal welfare issues that were highlighted in a report by Dr. Ian Duncan and Dr. Bernard Rowland were the intensive confinement systems that animals are kept in, painful mutilations that are done to them without any pain control, and as well as genetics breeding and selection. Picking breeds that are more geared towards higher production efficiency rather than high welfare. So those are the main themes. And no, I guess nothing was a surprise, but our point was to make other stakeholders who care about the other issues of a report pay attention to animal welfare as well. And I have to say, some of the scientists who contributed to the other parts of the report, this was new to them, the animal welfare section. So if anything, we've made the scientists who are experts on the impacts of intensive farming on rural communities be aware of the other problems to animal welfare.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, highlighting intersectionality and, of course, these interconnections between these various forms of oppression is always very important. But the report it isn't just a critique. It also has proactive recommendations. I actually want to touch on some of those.
Sure.
So could you actually provide a couple of examples? I know the report is chopped full of recommendations, and so it would take way more time to recover all of them. But could you highlight some of the most important structural changes you think that need to take place as soon as possible to ensure that these problems that you've highlighted can actually be alleviated?
Sure. Well, I guess the most important one to our organization is to phase out the cruelest confinement system. So the sow crates, the battery cages, the veal crates, and put an end to painful mutilations, especially without pain control. But definitely, we wouldn't need to mutilate animals if we kept them in a more natural environment that they could cope with. The other important one is to redirect subsidies towards the small family farmers that need it the most, and to use that money to encourage more humane, sustainable practices, rather propping up these intensive farms that have such high costs to Canadians and are not bringing any benefits. except to agribusiness. The other key recommendation is a very simple one that I do have high faith that policy makers in all parties will consider, is that at the very least, food needs to be labeled according to production methods. People have the right to know how their food is produced, and that should be according to, you know, they should know if it's being coming from a hen that's kept in a cage. Once they have that information, they can make more humane, sustainable choices.
So does the report actually call explicitly for the elimination of ILOs, or is it just about a question of regulation?
If our recommendations were adopted, ILOs wouldn't exist. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
They couldn't exist without unrestricted use of agricultural antibiotics and without intensive confinement systems and without these subsidies.
Great. So, of course, why does the WSPA recommend moving towards these small farm, local-based projects as opposed to advocating perhaps the elimination of animals in entirety?
It's just being practical. I think, you know, everyone can at least reduce their consumption of meat. Not everyone is ready to make the step towards vegetarian or vegan diet, and I think it's great if people are, but we want to speak to a larger population, and I think when people realize the high cost of their diet and that it's not sustainable, we simply do not have the land and resources to continue eating such high levels of meat as we have been. Our report shows that Canadians are among the highest meat consumers in the world, and other countries are not able to get enough meat to even ensure proper livelihoods and health. So our message is clear that, you know, at the very least, we want people to be conscientious eaters, to understand these implications, and I think everyone can reduce meat consumption.
Great, I definitely agree with that. Well, thanks so much, Melissa, for being on the show with us. I'm super glad that the WSPA has actually published this report. It's something that was very missing. Of course, most of these questions and topics are focused on the U.S. context, so it's great to have a Canadian setting illuminated. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. So now here are your headlines for May 5th, 2012. So we talked a little bit about Enbridge earlier in the show. 2 days ago, actually in Hartley Bay, British Columbia, the Gitgat Nation of Hartley Bay is actually reporting an oil spill between 2 and 5 miles long and 200 feet wide inside the Grenville Channel, not far from the proposed tanker route for the Enbridge Gateway Pipeline. The story is not being reported, so I find it especially important to illuminate it. If this spill is as big as the pilots are reporting, then we're looking at serious environmental impacts, including threats to our traditional shellfish harvesting areas, says Arnold Clifton, chief counselor of the Gitgat Nation. We need an immediate and full cleanup response from the federal government ASAP. Heavy oil known as Bunker C is thought to be upwelling from the USAT Brigadier General M.G. Zelensky, a U.S. Army transport ship that sank in 1946 with 700 tons of bunker fuel on board. The Canadian government has been saying that it would remove the oil and munitions from the ship since 2006, but with no results. So this actually brings to light what would potentially happen if there was a spill from the Enbridge pipelines. Right now, we're focusing on getting a handle on the size of the spill and the cleanup that's required, says Clifton. But this incident definitely raises questions about the federal government's ability to guard against oil spills and to honor its cleanup obligations. As a result, our nation has serious concerns about any proposal to have tankers travel through our coastal waters, including the Enbridge proposal.
I guess we'll be hearing in our next interview how this will affect the animals. And you were talking about salmon before, right?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. I mean, it affects both the Gitgat Nation, who actually depend on the ocean for 40% of their traditional diet, and, of course, the non-human wildlife that's in this area. So it affects us all. It's something that, you know, is very serious and needs to be more highlighted in the traditional news sources, which unfortunately it isn't. So the next headline we have is actually, we have another case of postmodern art gone awry. You may have heard of the fiasco at the Swedish Modern Art Museum not too long ago, wherein a performance art piece displayed a cake in the form of a black woman who screamed and shouted each time her abdomen was cut in order to raise attention to female genital mutilation. So this time we move to Berlin, where a German artist's plan to strangle puppies to death on stage was stopped by the courts. titled Death and Metamorphosis. The performance was to take place during this week, actually, at a small theater. The artist, who has not been identified, planned to use cable ties to strangle the dogs, followed by a brief meditation accompanied by funeral procession music and a giant gong. The performance was intended, if we are to take the artist at his word or her word, as a protest against the killing of sled dogs in Alaska and hunting dogs in Spain after they are deemed unfit to work. The Berlin Administrative Court intervened to stop the show. The harming of animals during the live performance is illegal. The artist had argued Germany's constitution unconditionally guarantees artistic freedom. So apparently...
Two conflicting regulations there, it sounds like.
It sounds like it. But of course, artistic freedom would seem to end when it comes to harming another being's life. Yeah, you'd think so, but apparently not to everyone. So this is actually very similar to the report actually coincided with another controversial project, which is also taking place at Berlin's University of the Arts, where two students threatened to guillotine a sheep on camera, depending on the results of a public vote. These two students aimed to explore ideas of humanity and democracy with an online poll deciding what should happen to the sheep. The poll has registered 190,000 no votes, 220,000 yes votes in its first 6 days. Despite complaints, the artists intend to reveal the results of the final vote at an exhibition.
So more yes kill the sheep votes? Is that, did I get that right?
No, there's more no. There's 190,000 no.
And how many yes?
120,000 yes.
Oh, almost as many.
Almost, yeah. The project they claim, of course, is that the anonymity of the internet lures the perversity out of some people, which is a statement from the two students, which definitely goes to show. So, I mean, the art project demonstrates that, but whether the mechanisms and means in which it need to demonstrate that needs to be debated perhaps more in the art scene, which I'm sure it is. The next news story is that in Maryland, in the U.S., a new ruling makes it easier for anyone attacked by a pit bull or a pit bull mix to take legal action against the dog's owner. The Maryland Court of Appeals ruling declared that pit bulls as a breed are inherently dangerous, and the owner of a pit bull or a crossbreed pit bull that attacks is strictly liable for damages, as is any landlord who rents to a pit bull owner. We believe that an animal's behavior should be the determining factor in whether or not the animal is considered dangerous, said Cheryl Bernard Smith of the SPCA. We don't believe that a particular breed should be pinpointed for that. All dogs, if you train them and show them love, can turn out to be mean or nice animals, said Rodney Taylor of Prince George's County Animal Management.
You know, all the personal stories that I've heard from pit bull owners are always speaking to how kind and affectionate and friendly their pit bull is. One thing I've learned about pit bulls is they always need to be like cuddling or attached to their owner because they're so friendly and affectionate, right? Like, and then, you know, of course, pit bulls that, or any dog, as you just said, that are trained to be the opposite are going to be the opposite, but it doesn't, I don't think it has to do with breed,
definitely.
Honestly, from what I hear from people.
Definitely. I mean, it seems to me a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where if we project on a species that they're going to be mean, therefore we treat them as if they're going to be mean, and then they become mean.
Or maybe the people that want, typically buy pit bulls, not rescuing, are the ones that want to breed them to be mean animals.
Perhaps. So those have been your headlines for May 5th, 2012. And now we're going to have our second feature interview with Abraham DeLeon, Dr. DeLeon, he's the assistant professor in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Hi, doctor.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Dr.
How about yourself?
Good, I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk to you guys. I was just liking to reflect on what you were talking about pit bulls, and I thought that was just a really interesting piece. I myself own a bull terrier, and they are absolutely the sweetest dogs breed I've ever encountered.
Told you.
And to see them constructed this way really speaks more to how human beings kind of construct our understanding of animals versus what they inherently are, right? So I just thought that was interesting.
Definitely. I mean, it definitely shows the way these kind of constructions are institutionalized within the court systems themselves. So you actually recently planned to deliver a paper at a conference here in Vancouver, and I don't want to talk too much about this, but you were denied entry into Canada. So we'll actually be talking about the paper you plan to present. But before we do, is there anything you wanted to say upon this reflection of this incident? Because if I'm, you know, Googling your name, this is almost kind of seems to be the top story associated with your name.
Yeah, I think that I was denied entry to Canada. I wasn't given a firm reason about why that happened, and I don't really want to speak too much more about that. But I think it really demonstrates the idea that, you know, people are absolutely paying attention to what we say. There's definitely vested interest in making sure that bodies don't move from space to space. And when you experience that kind of rejection on the border, you really understand how the border really is this nebulous space. And so I was privileged enough to come back to my life and resume my way of life rather easily. But I really feel for those people that are trapped in these kinds of nebulous spaces that don't have the kind of voice and the access to kind of privilege that I do. So
yeah, definitely. So, of course, this paper that you intended to present was called The Lure of the Animal, The Theoretical Question of the Non-Human Animal. And it deals with the need to include non-human animals in educational theory and teaching. So can you tell us a bit about educational literature and why it seems to have avoided the question of the non-human for so long, and why exactly you think there's an impetus right now to include it?
Well, there's always been a strong kind of critical, radical edge to educational theory. Unfortunately, over the past 10 years, with the passage of things like No Child Left Behind and these kinds of standardized, positivistic-like ways of knowing, we see kind of educational research take a different turn, more directed towards measuring student outcomes, measuring testing scores and things like that. So when I wrote this paper, I was really wanted to have teachers and people that were kind of in the educational milieu really engage with non-human animals, not just because of the animal per se, but the idea about how we construct a non-human animal, right? Because that's really kind of where I attack it, is our kind of philosophical kind of the knowledge that we think we have about animals, and what other perfect place than to engage people's ideas through education, you know, through schooling. So I that's why I really saw a kind of a niche and a necessary kind of conversation that needs to be had. And not only that, I really think in education we really kind of solidify what we think the human is, and I don't really think there's really much evidence to provide that really shows us who we think we are. And so this also kind of throws into question this binary between human and animal, and education seems to be the kind of perfect avenue to have these kind of critical conversations.
Definitely, and you actually argue in the paper, of course, that what non-human means is a key to understanding what human means. And so you actually argue that the objectification and degradation of non-human animals was a key tactic for the colonial enterprise.
That
it seems to me, if I'm interpreting correctly, that non-human animals were actually key to the ability to otherize other humans. So can you actually explain how these processes worked and what you mean by this?
Yeah, if we look at historically how colonization happened, I mean, before colonization even kind of occurred in the 17th, 18th centuries, right, when we see the push for Europeans to really expand outside of their borders, there really was a firm idea about another already in place before they met, you know, indigenous peoples in, say, South America or Africa or Southeast Asia, right? There was already a firm idea of who the other was, and that other was an animal. So these kind of practices of domination, zoos, vivisection, these kind of cultural representations of animals, you know, all the way back to kind of classical philosophy and science, you know, entrenched in the kind of European mind was this idea of who the animal was. And I argue in this paper particularly that all Europeans did was kind of transfer this knowledge of domination they perfected on non-human bodies to kind of the other human, right, that then became beastly and, you know, over-sexualized and exotic. And so all these practices that they had before Europeans practiced colonization, they did that on the bodies of non-human animals. And so when I talk about the other, you know, in like the West, Western society, we tend to try to construct our sense of self against something that we're not. And so that animal is always going to be that ultimate other, right? That voiceless kind of creature that exists on the periphery of our society, that's locked up in zoos, that's put in cages, that's vivisected, that's, you know, all these kinds of terrible things. And so when I talk about the other, it's that thing that exists outside of who we think we are. When I say we, I'm talking about the kind of dominant kind of Eurocentric culture that exists in the West. And I particularly pick on the West because I was born in the United States, and I definitely understand that there's constructions of animals that happens other places differently. But I particularly focused on Western European culture because I feel like that had such a powerful impact on not only the kind of institutions in which I work with, but in kind of American society as well.
Great. So, I mean, of course, what you just explained seems to work very well on how you I guess, phrase and work, Michel Foucault's work on knowledge power, into your own work, that of course non-human animals function within systems of knowledge and truth to enable us to understand who we are as humans. But there seems to be also kind of two processes at work, at least what I garnered from your paper, that on the one hand, what we know about culture is mediated and naturalized through the way we represent animals. On the other hand, we also see that animals are also not divorced from culture, at least the way we see animals. And so you also place the zoo as a central feature in this relationship between culture, animals, and truth. Could you touch upon a bit how the zoo actually functions as an example of kind of the locus of power knowledge in this instance?
Well, zoos have always represented this kind of colonial expansion and kind of a space of quote-unquote scientific discovery, right? They were also used historically as like the bazaars and fairs, the kind of like exotic spoil that Europeans would bring back from imperial conquest. So really, zoos have always supported the kind of ideology of domination, right? It naturalizes the idea that the animal is there for us to consume and to look at, to gaze upon the body of the animal in its quote-unquote natural environment, right? And so this also lends to these kinds of processes of incarceration, this idea that science is this objective kind of truth measure that can tell us about the world, right? When there's actually a lot of indigenous ways of knowing and a lot of critical scholarship that's emerged that's really throwing into these kinds of questions of truth and this idea of can we ever really know what it means to be animal, right? So I think zoos have always kind of naturalized our domination over non-human animals. It also justifies kind of incarceration as well as that body of the animal that's kind of rendered completely meaningless in the context of the zoo. So the zoos are really kind of an extension of how this kind of, you know, envelopment between power and knowledge exists. And so, you know, the power and knowledge are always going to be discursive, right? They're always going to be enveloped in not only language, but also kind of our practices. So when we talk about practices of domination, we have to talk about things like zoos. We have to talk things like vivisection. Because if we don't talk about these practices, then we won't really understand how these ideologies are lived and expressed.
Definitely. So, of course, also your paper proposes an interesting and relatively unique way to move beyond the non-human-human binary. But before we touch on that, I actually want to discuss some of your other work. So you're also heavily invested in anarchist theory and anarchist literature, and you similarly argue that educational theory has not taken account of anarchism. So why is also anarchist theory so important, or do you believe that anarchist theory is so important for teachers and educators?
I think, can I take a step back and kind of define, I think, what I mean by anarchism?
Of course,
first?
I think that's definitely needed.
Yeah, and so because I think there's this kind of idea that the anarchists, and especially the way that we're represented in the kind of mainstream media, the, you know, this wild-eyed kind of chaotic individual wrapped up in a black face mask that wants to destroy capitalism, smash the state. Now, that's definitely a part of the culture and tradition, but it also definitely moves beyond that, right? It's about building new forms of autonomous organization. It's about building community. It's about resisting the state. It's about seeing beauty through different forms of aesthetic paradigms. It's about questioning our role in the world and how we can come to govern ourselves outside of these kind of bureaucratic hierarchical structures. So when I talk about anarchism, that's the kind of anarchism I envision, right? And so when we talk about education's linked to anarchism, I mean, when we talk about anarchist practice, for example, so anarchists reject this idea of the state. So we do practices like direct action, right? So direct action are these kind of direct political interventions. We don't ask permission. We don't ask permission from the state. We do things invested that's going to improve our community. So, for example, I think of Food Not Bombs. You know, Food Not Bombs feeds the homeless, although all of them may not profess to be anarchist, it's very anarchistic in spirit, right? So I really see the kinds of direct action, not, you know, kind of rejection of authority, really helping teachers be able to think outside of this kind of standardized, kind of really bland educational experiences that seem to be going on in a lot of places in the U.S. So that's why I really see that kind of direct action component, that kind of rejection of kind of traditional authority structures. I really see that integral as teachers being able to kind of move beyond these just really simple-minded, standardized ways of knowing.
So what do you see yourself as in the relationship between anarchism and animal rights? What can anarchist theory actually teach us about non-human animals? And similarly, what do you see critical animal studies as providing new insights into anarchist literature and theory? Of course, you know, the anarchist community and scene has always been heavily involved, it seems to me, in the plight of animals. But what
Absolutely.
Do you see as the locus between the two movements?
Well, I want to return back to this idea of direct action and sabotage, right? This idea that really anarchists that have been involved in the animal liberation movement have really taken to task these ideas. All right, we're going to shut down this center, this place, this lab, because of what it's doing to non-humans, right? We're going to disrupt this whatever because of its role in oppressive practices towards non-humans. We're going to throw paint on people that wear fur because of the problematic things that go on in the development of fur and fur products. So I think anarchism really has provided a lot of animal rights activists with really the kind of language and the ideas and the theories that we have to do something now. Right? There's no more waiting for tomorrow. There's no more appealing to government authorities to ask permission. We need to do it now, right? So I think that's one of the things that anarchists has provided for animal rights activists. And I don't want to say that the ALF is anarchist, right, because I don't know if a lot of them would claim anarchism, but the stuff that the ALF has done historically through the 80s and 90s up until recently has been very anarchistic in nature. So I try to look at these kinds of, in my own work, I try to look at these groups that have embodied anarchist tactics, even though they may not call themselves anarchist, you know?
Definitely.
Animal Liberation Front, ALF, for our listeners who
correct.
Don't know.
I'm sorry, yes. Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front, Earth First, these kinds of direct action groups that I support, I think are kind of embodying anarchist theory in very, very interesting ways, you know, and contradictions as well. So there's all kinds of, it's never a clear-cut thing, right? It's never going to be right or wrong. There's always going to be shades of gray. So it's interesting to look at this kind of animal rights activism through an anarchist lens, pretty, no doubt.
Definitely. So if I can add one, I guess one or two more segments of intersection here, it seems to be also that the animal rights movement and also the anarchist movement has also been charged with being dominated by people who identify as white, and
yeah.
Well, in other words, by white privilege as well. So where do you see yourself in this position here? Because it seems to me that discussions of race, both in anarchist, at least in the predominant published anarchist and animal rights literature, is somewhat absent. And of course, being a male scholar of color, it seems to me that you're in a unique position here. How do you situate yourself in regards to your work and this question of race?
Yeah, that's such an important question, but I don't know if I have an answer to it. I mean, I don't know why anarchism has been dominated by whiteness. I think that's been changing over the past few years, but absolutely it came from a Eurocentric model. I mean, if we look at early anarchists, I mean, they emerged out of the Western European experience. So I don't know if we're ever going to be able to divorce anarchism from Eurocentrism, right? But that also, this is the complex thing, right? Like, I can't come up with an answer why,
yeah,
you know, why it's been dominated, but I think it's problematic, definitely, and I think it's something as a community, and I know as a scholar of color that speaks to anarchism, when I read anarchism, it definitely stirs something inside me. It produces an affect that, for me, speaks to some kind of, you know, lower little t truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lowercase t truth, but it's something that I think definitely needs to be discussed, because when I read anarchism, and I was just getting to that, but as I read anarchism, I also am struck by its kind of rooted in whiteness, you know, this kind of dominant ways of understanding and knowing the world, not really engaging enough with kind of indigenous kind of pre-colonization ideas about the world. So I think that it's a tough question, and I don't really think I have an answer for that, but I think a lot of anarchists are aware of that, and I think that it's something that I hope we address in the next, in the next decade, because I think that's going to be important to kind of bring people around to ideas about what anarchism has to offer.
Definitely.
Us political agitation.
And of course, that's why it's so important to have scholars such as yourself dealing on these questions. But if I can turn now back to your work on animals, so you talk
sure.
about, so one of the ideas you talk about is moving beyond the human non-human binary is something the French philosophers Gauss, Gilles Deleuze, and Felix Guattari talk about,
yeah.
which they talk about known as becoming animal. Can
right.
you talk about a bit about this concept of becoming and how it helps us move beyond the human non-human binary?
Well, becoming is a really kind of complex concept, and I don't think a lot of scholars have worked through it, but I'll kind of tell you how I've come to understand it, because when you try to read Deleuze and Guattari, it's formidable. So I think one of the things that when I talk about becoming, it is really, it's a generative process, right? It's a new way of being. It's trying to think outside of this reality that we're given. So, you know, when I came into the academic game in 2000, like, I wasn't some seasoned radical that came in, you know, just ready to take on the institution. Like, I was a pretty straight-laced, voted Democrat kind of guy that didn't really see the world in this way. So, but I allowed the knowledge that I encountered in the academy, the kind of the voices of the scholars that came before me, the animal rights stuff, animal liberation, anarchism, critical pedagogy, these kinds of traditions, I allowed them to transform me. I became something different, right? And so I think that's a good example to think about becoming, you know. Becoming is always about trying to transcend the ideas about our own subjectivities and what we're given, trying to think about what it would mean to be animal. Now, we can never cross that species divide, ever, but at least we can try to think about what it would mean to hold a different type of subjectivity, to exist on a different type of plane of existence than we're given as truth and reality. One of the things that Deleuze and Guattari always talk about, though, the key process to becoming is always producing something, right? Whether that's producing a new piece of art, whether that's producing writing, whether that's producing a curriculum plan, say, like, if you're stuck in a kind of a, if you're a teacher stuck in a school. I mean, it's producing something that forces us to engage the world in a different way. That's the way I've understood becoming, right? I mean, we can get into the philosophical debate about what that is, but when I talk about becoming, it's transcending my own reality in the best ways that I can in the situation that I'm giving. It's to become something different that I was not before, you know?
Great. Yeah, thanks so much. It's definitely...
I hope that's clear.
No, it's definitely a very interesting concept.
Thank you.
Very quickly, is your essay available online anywhere on free access? Any of us in this
game? It is. If your listeners want to go to Critical Education, which is the online journal, if they can just Google Critical Education, they'll find it. It's actually hosted out of the University of British Columbia. Sandra Matheson, Stephen Petrina, E. Wayne Ross are all faculty members there. I'm an associate editor. They've decided to host this kind of special section that I've done with non-human animals. And so you can access the article through just Googling Critical Education out of UBC.
Great. Thanks so much, Abraham. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, I think it's great what you guys are doing. You know, it's funny, CNN actually called me the other day and wanted to interview me about the quote-unquote anarchists, supposed anarchists that blew up or were going to blow up the Ohio Bridge, some bridge in Ohio, and I was flat squarely told them no. You know, I told them I'm not going to be involved in these kinds of terror, whatever, quote-unquote terrorist acts that, by people that may or may not be labeled anarchists. But when I received you guys' questions and the idea that you actually engaged my thought, I was very impressed. So I'm always willing to talk to people that are, you know, mindful about their journalism and the way that they're reporting. So I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much, Abraham.
Take care.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, we'll be doing a feature interview with Jan Olson, who is the founder of A Better Life Dog Rescue and a new local organization called Ban Resident Dogs. She'll be speaking to us about the work she does for her organizations to rescue dogs chained in backyards and what she is doing to appeal to local communities to put a stop to chaining animals. We'll also have Alyssa presenting a segment called Life Through Eyes of a Dairy Cow in honor of Mother's Day next week. And I just wanted to say we're leaving you with Baby Beluga by Rafi, a song from my childhood, my very first album on record. Stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Sea below, and a little white whale on the go. Baby beluga, baby beluga. Is the water warm? Is your mama home with you? So happy. Way down yonder where the dolphins play, where you dive and splash all day. Waves rolling and the waves roll out. See the water squirting out of your spout. Baby beluga, oh baby beluga. Sing your little song, sing for all your friends. We like to hear you. Snug in your water bed, moon.
morning and the stars are out. Good night, little whale, good night. Baby beluga, oh baby beluga, with tomorrow's sun, another day's begun. You'll soon be waking, baby beluga, in the deep blue sea. Swim so wild and you swim so free. Heaven above and the sea below, and a little white whale on the go. You're just a little white whale on the go.